Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
Hi, everybody. How you doing?
Scott, do you think the Adam and Eve promo is distinctly locked into 2012 and 2013?
No, because it's a pretty basic promo. I mean, as far as promos go, it's you could hear it even in the 30s saying that if you use the promo code STATIC.
Keep going.
Okay. You could save 50% on any single item, almost. You get free shipping anywhere in the U.S. Three, count them, one, two, three free DVDs. And for some reason, I've gone Australian there at the end, so never mind. But
Foster's three, Australian for DVDs.
I have no idea. I have no idea why.
And
but
free three U.S. shipping, DVDs,
free U.S. shipping, and a mystery gift, and a nice warm feeling that you're helping Josh keep the lights on.
You're gonna tell them what they have to do for that?
I told you, use the promo code STATIC at the end of the. Okay. You know, once you're done shopping, use the promo code STATIC. You give money to Josh.
And you, technically.
I haven't seen it for the last year.
Because you said you didn't need it, fucko.
I don't. I have a job.
Ooh. So tonight's topic, I want to talk about art and how it either changes or doesn't. And this is technically going to be about perception rather than the art itself. And when I say art, I'm using the all-encompassing art.
Everything from painting to Garfunkel?
Well, past Garfunkel, actually. Garfunkel might be included, but yes. That was a really bad joke, by the way.
yes, it was.
But I mean, like, you know, as soon as you see, like, say, an old comic book, you see an old comic book cover.
All right.
You not being a comic book fan might not know when that is from. But you can look at the art style. You can look at the logo layout. You can look at the font they used, the coloring, and you can usually just immediately look at that and go, that's from the late 70s.
And I can tell you something else, even as a non-comic book fan, since I haven't, you know, pored over, I probably from the comic book art, I might go, okay, that looks like it might be 70s, that looks like it might be 80s, and I'd probably be right
relatively close.
One out of four times or so. But if I go and I look at the ads, and I look at the style of the ads and the products that they're advertising, then I can tell you what.
Well, I'm just talking the cover right now. That all you're seeing is this one piece of artwork.
Then
that's
so
all
long,
you're seeing.
So long as it's not an Archie comic.
Which haven't changed since the 50s, yeah.
So long as it's not an Archie
Let's
comic.
Let's say it's a Batman or an X-Men comic, okay?
Then yeah, I could probably get pretty close, or at least within the decade, simply based on the costume that the hero has. And maybe, who knows, maybe it's a topical comic book and they're, you know.
Or you could nicely date yourself with the Dazzler comic, because she was a recording artist as well as a X-Man. So all the girls were buying her LP, and one of the covers was her LP cover.
Oh, really?
With them taking the LP out.
Oh.
You just go, yeah, that doesn't date this to 1983, does it?
Okay.
But what I mean by that is, you can tell, not even, let's leave the actual content out, like the costume that the hero is wearing, or even the hairstyle of somebody in there. You can usually tell by the art itself, by the font. You know, certain fonts just go late 70s or 1980s, don't they?
Yeah, that's true. Like, you know, that if you get that kind of psychedelic flower power type font, that just screams 1960s.
Yeah, it screams late 60s. Or you get that very hard-edged with neon, you just go, oh, early 80s. It's clearly early 80s.
Exactly. Or speaking of neon, you can look at a neon sign on the road and you can go, that was made in the 50s.
Yeah.
If it's still got kind of that end of the Art Deco.
But you see what I mean, how it's got a certain style.
Oh, yeah.
To when the art, in this case just visual art, was made.
Well, sure. Architecture, too.
Well, then I'm going to ask you the more esoteric question, why? Why does that immediately, in your mind, and I'm asking of the audience as well, make you go 70s, 80s, 60s, 90s, whatever it happens to be? Why is that one thing cemented into your head? Even if you didn't live through it. We weren't alive in the 50s, yet we can notice 50s style artwork immediately.
We weren't alive in the 30s, but you can go to a building and see that beautiful Art Deco or Egyptian Renaissance type architecture and go, oh, 30s.
Right. So I'm asking you, since you know the audience can't answer right now, why is that? Why do you think the art dates itself, intentionally or not, to the specific time period that it was made in, rather than being something more timeless, that something made in the 1970s looks like it could have been done in the 90s? Because, for example, you're familiar with the artist Frank Frazetta, right?
Yeah.
Beautiful painter.
Yes.
A lot of his stuff was done in the 60s and 70s, and it looks like they could have been comic book or VHS covers in the 90s. His art didn't date very, very badly.
Well, I to answer your first question of why does this stuff rise and fall and why is it decade specific? It's actually a very simple answer. Art and artists and design in general thrive on fads, whether it's a decade-long fad of a design type or whether it's some other type of fad. When it comes to design and when it comes to advertising and when it comes to a lot of that art that we get exposed to in our life.
Are you talking pop culture, more or less?
Pop culture, art, yeah, definitely. Even when you look at paintings and you look at some of the classics and you go, that is definitely a Renaissance painting. Or if you look at like the textiles and they have that very... very that you look at and you go, okay, this is clearly out of a time in art when we hadn't started playing with perspective because it's very flat and stuff like that.
You know which one I'm thinking of since you brought up architecture in there?
Sure.
Is that very 80s, and it always just makes me go back to Miami Vice, but I saw it on lots of other things. Those walls made out of those clear yet opaque cubes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's an 80s thing, which I think is pretty cool, actually. I've always wanted a wall like that.
That kind of are you talking about the frosted glass cubes?
Yeah, where they're opaque enough that you can't clearly see through them,
right?
But you can still see through them if that makes sense.
Right. No, I understand that. Well, if you go down to Disney World in Florida, or even if you're nowhere near,
good God, Epcot Center is so.
Epcot just screams future world, screams 1980s. It screams, this is the future of the 1980s. And it's
from a 1960s perspective, kind of.
Not even. Well, no, that's Tomorrowland.
Oh,
Tomorrowland,
okay. Sorry, I'm thinking of the wrong one.
You're thinking of Tomorrowland and that now they advertise it as the future of days gone by is how they're getting away with that. But it just, it just screams late 1950s, early 60s idea of the future. Walk over to Epcot Center down in Florida, and it just screams, this is the future of the 1980s.
Now, do you mean this is the future of the 1980s or the future envisioned by the 1980s?
Envisioned by.
Because I personally, as an 80s movie fan, I love seeing 80s movies that said, this is what the 90s are going to be like. This is what the 2000s are going to be like. I absolutely love that. It gives it a very unique retro future feel. Does that make any sense?
Like I said, the future of days gone by. Because you watch the Jetsons. You watch the Jetsons and you see the technology and you go, okay, that was the future of the 1950s. They were sure that by...
The 60s.
The 60s. By the time the year 2000 came around, that was going to be what was going on. We were all, you know...
Flying cars. Robot butlers and
exactly.
Everything.
And then... as time progressed, you know, if you ask somebody from the 1980s, what is the future going to be like? You're going to get a picture that looks, I hate to say it, but it looks a lot like Tron.
Well, or
meaning not necessarily that.
Well, it depends on what kind of future you're going for. I think I agree with you that it would be kind of Tron-ish and that, I guess
that color palette that Tron used and the
neon,
blues
lots
and
of
pinks,
neon.
Lots of neon with red highlights and stuff like that. You get that very unique color palette that was definitely of the future. And
well, because like one of the examples I always go to, and I actually pitched I'll get to that in a sec. You've seen Escape from New York, right?
Yes.
1981?
Yes.
It takes place in the future of 1997, okay?
Right.
And, you know, they're still using cassette tapes to transfer, you know, presidential data and stuff like that on it. And it's very much a 90s envisioned by the early 80s.
Sure.
So Hank Carlson and I pitched an idea to a producer about a Snake Plissken prequel series where he's still got two eyes and everything. And the producer shot us down, most likely for money reasons. But our thing was, we don't want this to be set in some current future. We want this to be set in the future of 1981's version of the 90s. Like, it's, you know, Escape from New York takes place in 97. Our version took place in 94. But we want that with cassette tapes and these big cars. And, you know, and they're like, do you realize how goddamn expensive that would be?
Yes.
It's like, yes, but it would be a really unique look, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would. It really would.
Or like, you're a big Quantum Leap fan?
No.
You weren't?
No.
Never watched it?
Never was a fan. I no.
Okay. Early 90s. I think it started in 89, actually. Take place in 99, you know, when the Quantum Leap project began.
Okay.
And they had a couple episodes where we got to see outside Project Quantum Leap in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
It looked like a Miami Vice episode on crack. Neon everywhere. And it was just so funny to see their version of what they thought the 1990s were going to be.
Sure.
Even on a smart show like Quantum Leap.
Mm-hmm.
So then why do we stop these styles? You know, like, why all of a sudden did neon go out? Why all of a sudden did those opaque frosted brick walls just kind of go out? Let's even go to the 70s. Why did all of a sudden people go, I'm not wearing bell bottoms anymore. Bell bottoms are stupid. I mean, there's got to be a cutoff point, right?
I don't know if there's really a cutoff point, because,
or is it a gradual
shift? It's a gradual shift. It's a gradual shift that happens quickly, if that makes sense.
Where gradual, quickly, those are contradictory terms, Scott.
I realize that, but if you picture a fade out and a fade up in music, it's a quick fade out and a quick fade up.
But it signifies a transition.
But it signifies a transition. And, you know, yes, in 1983, I can guarantee there were still lots of people wearing bell bottoms and stripes with checks, and a lot of people
leisure
still wearing
suits.
Yeah, there were still leisure suits around, and they sold them up until, I think, 89. So be it. But on the whole, yeah, they do fade out and fade up trends. And there's a few reasons that why I think these trends happen. You'll notice that they kind of happen in decades. I say
more or less.
I say 50s, you get a very distinct view. I say 60s, and suddenly it's 1968 specifically.
Well, like, what do you think of when you think of certain decades? Like, you just brought up the 50s.
Sure.
Me, I immediately go atomic age.
Yeah, me too. I go, you know, the good obedient little boy in school watching those horrible, horrible school education
duck and
films.
Cover, bitch.
Not even necessarily duck and cover, but, you know, Billy is a bad boy. Billy doesn't wash his hands after he pees, you know, and that kind of stuff with the buzz cut, the freckled face, the smiling, and, you know,
no black people in
sight. No black people anywhere. There were no black people in the United States in the 50s, if you look at the film industry.
Well, then, okay, 60s.
60s, boom, hippies.
I was going to say flower children, but yeah, it's the same thing.
Flower children, hippies, you immediately think jeans are in fashion now. They're no longer, you know, people are no longer really wearing business attire. It's not cool. So you wear jeans, you've got the bell bottoms, you've got pot, everything.
Everybody's high.
Everything smells of pot. And you think of automobiles like the minibus and the VW Beetle and stuff like that.
Okay, 70s.
70s.
I go for sort of a washed out afro, even on white guys.
Studio 54.
You see, you and I go to a different place when it comes to the 70s.
Yeah.
But, and then 80s, I go poofy hair and neon.
Flock of Seagulls, yeah.
And then 90s, I would have to go emasculated male.
See,
you can't really fight me on that one. The 90s was the decade of the emasculated male.
Yeah, I'm not fighting you on that one at all. I'm really not. But at the same time, you mentioned 90s, and I get a few different pictures. I get the grunge picture. You know, so you had the grunge guys with the flannel and the t-shirt. Then that's where I lived, in the flannel, the t-shirt, the jeans, listening to Nirvana. And then you if you look at the hip-hop community in the 90s.
Gangsta.
You've got either gangsta or you've got the other side. You've got the safe rap of Will Smith and
Bill Biv DeVoe. Okay, yeah. I knew it was close somewhere in there.
And you know, so, and there, you know, the safe hip hop is in the clean neon clothing where everything's too big.
Pastels.
But yeah, pastels. A lot of pastels. Whereas gangsta is more inner city and you've got the chains,
do-rags,
and the gold and the do-rag and the intimidating side of it all. On the other side of grunge, you've got 90s hair metal, which was kind of 80s leftovers, but they were still there.
For the first couple of years.
For the first few years. And then, you know, then you have the 90s boy bands.
Which goes back to my emasculated male.
Yeah, the nice, clean, white boy that, you know, the girls are happy to bring home to mom. But you know that he's got four friends, and one's fat, and one's a bad boy, and one's innocent, and one, you know.
Okay, then let's move 2000s. What do you think of? I think of tech and cell phones growing out of everyone's head.
Yeah. I think of cyborgs, and it sounds silly, but
no, that's what these people are. Okay, when we worked at 26, it was sad. By the time I got quit from there, everybody was constantly having an iPod or a cell phone that they were playing with, and I'm like, "Do you remember that when you started there?"
Yeah, no. Because, well, no, I had my iPod with me in the studio because we had a lot of downtime.
I always had a paperback.
And I brought my iPod and played with it. And everybody used to make fun of me. They're like, Scott's always playing games and has nothing better to. And then, yeah, even by the time I left, everybody had a phone.
Yeah,
and
you'd become cyborgized.
Yeah.
Cybernized. I don't even know what word I'm going
cybernized.
For. Okay. So let's talk from art to music art.
Okay.
We're going to play you guys a couple of samples. And we're going to go in order, so this is not a challenge. But you tell us if we're wrong that like this does not immediately scream within the first few bars, 60s.
Till everything turn. There is a season, turn, and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to reap, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to laugh, a time.
So tell me, did that not just scream 60s as soon as you heard it?
Oh, well, I mean, how many filmmakers do you know have used those very beginning chords just to put you right back into the 60s?
Right, which is what I'm saying. This turn by the Byrds, which my other choice was going to be 8 Miles High from the Byrds, but Scott and I agreed turn worked better.
Yep.
And I'm asking you then, why does that signify the 60s so much? Was it just the style that eventually evolved or just went out of fashion of music? Or is there just something inherent in what that song is that screams 60s?
Well, I think there's a few things. One, you've got the technology that the band is using. The electric guitar, simply because of how they were made, in the 1960s, had a very distinct sound. A 1963 guitar is going to sound very, very different from a 1984 guitar.
Agreed.
And that's just, since that's what they used, they ended up with that sound. You had the musical fad and the chord progressions that they were using. The Byrds, That's a song in a minor key. This was coming out of the 50s, out of that major rah-rah America post-war sound and that very major key tone of Motown that was getting kind of big in the 50s and moving into the 60s. And you had a generation of people rebelling against their parents. And so they switch over to a minor key.
Not just their parents, the government too.
Right, right. Well, made up of their parents.
Yeah. I'm just saying, I always think of the 60s rebellion as more of a cultural rebellion right. than a fuck my parents, fuck my dad.
Well, one generation revolting against another. How's that?
Okay.
And then on top of that, you've got the content of the song, the lyrical content. In the 60s, you heard a lot of folk. There was a folk rebirth. There was, which is
unfortunately the Joan Baez nonsense.
You had a lot of political meaning in songs where 50s, you know, a lot of the 50s, a do 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 da da.
50s were very radio safe. The 60s started to push it a little, not as much as the 70s.
Right, but you had that folk sound, that revolutionary sound to it. And again, the political message packed into it as well that you didn't get in the 50s or the 40s or at any decade prior, frankly. And even the Motown hits of the 80s, even that black music that they started playing on the radio, that had a political message as well, too, that you saw the birth of the civil rights movement in the music, and you heard that switch. As soon as Motown hit, you heard that switch, and I hate to say it, but white people followed along. They were actually a little late to the party,
as we tend to be.
Yep.
So do you think that the 60s music is stuck in the 60s, or do you think 60s music in general has the ability to transcend its decade, or is it, and again, in general, or is it of its decade, that 60s music will always sound like 60s music to you?
It is of its decade, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. You know, I enjoy, there's a lot of 60s music that I enjoy. There's a lot of stuff that the Beatles did in the 60s, and especially in their drug years. There's a lot of stuff that the Doors did that I love from the 60s. And yes, it screams 1960s. Does that mean that, you know, content-wise, it doesn't have a message for us today? No. I'm sure it still has a message for decades further. That's why it has lasted. But it is of the 60s.
Okay, then let's move into the 1970s.
Okay.
We had a big debate over this one, but does this sound 70s to you guys?
Because 70s, you know, you say 1970s to me, and like I said, my brain goes to Club 54 and disco.
And see, my brain immediately went to Black Sabbath Paranoid, but then we compromised.
We found
on
something
this.
In the middle that still screamed 1970s.
Yeah, but you and I were on opposite ends.
Ziggy played guitar, jamming good, in web and gilly, and the spiders from Mars. We played it left hand, but made it too far.
So we compromised with Bowie.
Yeah, and you can't go wrong with Bowie. For the record, Dawn and I are both huge Bowie fans, and frankly, I think he's one of the most gorgeous men to walk the face of this earth. He wasn't, not always, but from about 1996 on, he got really cute.
Wow,
sorry.
That's weird. But no, it's like I said, you and I went to opposite ends of this, though. Right. I went Paranoid. That, to me, is 70s.
You went to that 70s metal where things started getting heavy. And where things started, you started seeing the political message that we saw in folk in the 60s infuse itself into the metal scene as well.
And start to get psychedelic as well.
Because, mm-hmm.
like, just look at the video for Paranoid. You can't tell me that's not made for people on acid.
Right. And that's the 70s was the decade that we started seeing metal get heavy. And then, like I said, like you said, I went to the Club 54 side because to me, absolutely nothing says 1970s like that, like Bee Gees or throwaway disco music.
Yeah, see, I laid down the one rule for the 70s: we can't go disco.
Yeah, no,
disco cannot, because it's almost, to me, Scott, feels like a cheap shot. You know, going disco for the 70s almost feels like a cheap shot to me.
It's easy.
Yeah, which is why it's like, no, I knew you were going to go 60, or I knew you were going to go disco.
Look at the bright side. I didn't go the other way that we could have gone, which was 70s adult contemporary, where you ended up with things like Afternoon Delight, and or that I can't remember the name of the...
It's
Easy Loving You, or, you know.
Or you could have gone more pop. And going like, working at the car wash, yeah. You know? That's more middle of the ground pop.
Well, see, the 70s too, we saw the rise of blaxploitation. And black America really found a voice in the 70s. And they found their voice in music, and they found their voice in movies.
We'll get to movies, though.
I know. But in music, you had the Jackson 5 pop up, and that whole
Jackson 5 was really safe black music.
It was really safe black music, you're right, but it signified, there was something that the Jackson 5 had that the Osmonds never had.
Talent.
I don't know, they're very rich, there had to be some sort of talent there.
But
nonetheless, you had the soul sound. You had a lot of people looked at a lot of white America in the 70s looked to black America and saw something really sexy and fascinating, and that's why you also ended up with things like Al Green and Barry White making these sensual, distinctly African American love songs.
You also had the, not the birth, but the American birth of reggae.
Yeah.
You know, where you had Bob Marley and that really starting to come over to America.
And reggae, American reggae has a very interesting birth sound to it. It started getting popular in the 70s, especially as the 60s faded out. And as the protest generation and that generation that was always fighting the man of 1968 started to fade away, there was still a good chunk of people looking for something to rebel against. And here we have
I Shot the Sheriff, which is very radio friendly reggae. That,
right.
You know.
But yeah, reggae was still rebelling, especially in Caribbean countries and some African countries and in some of the Afro-Latin countries that are down in the South. It was still a music of rebellion, especially Marley. And so America kind of picked it up and went, wait, we're not done rebelling yet. Let's listen to this. And hey, look, we can call ourselves Rastafarian and smoke up too.
Well, then what is the, because you talked about how the 60s had that sound and the equipment and the styling. What makes this a 70s song? Let's just say a general 70s song, 70s.
Well, a lot of it has to do with the beat.
I was just about to say, a lot of 70s songs, even the good ones, they do have a very repetitive beat. It's, you know, you use that chorus numerous times. It's not a one or two time chorus. It's a 7-time and a 3-minute song chorus.
Right. But it's, you know, it's a 4-4 beat. It's the 70s also was the birth of the funky drummer beat, which I'll play for you in a little bit. But the funky drummer it's been used throughout the 80s and the 90s, especially in hip hop. In the 70s, you had the disco beat, and that's very easy to pick up. And you had that, even in rock and across music in general, you had this rise in the use of symphonic sound. I mean, in disco, you hear a distinct violin,
which you'd hear more into the 80s. But like, okay, how about something like Kiss then, who made a disco album? That, you know, obviously their worst, but also immediately dates it to the 70s even more than Kiss's earlier albums, which were more of the 70s.
Right.
All of a sudden you go, holy shit, Kiss disco. Yeah. What the hell? This was 70s and clearly selling out.
Well, disco was one of those flash in the pan.
Well, like music styles. Like a 4-year flash in the pan.
Well, over the history of music, yeah, that's a flash in the pan. You know, and that's it was distinctly 70s. Also in the 70s in adult contemporary, you have that easy listening sound. I mean, again, I mentioned
AM radio,
Afternoon Delight. That AM radio.
It's what I was always what I was called AM radio music.
Yeah, and it's that distinct, easygoing, symphonic sound to it. Even 70s metal, which is rebelled against all of that, still again the
it was still relatively simple though.
The instruments that they used, the technology they started to explore, you know, even the 70s stuff that has synthesizers like The Who and stuff like that, very distinctly 70s synth sound because they were just starting to play with that artificial
music.
See,
the one, and you might disagree with me, the one place I say doesn't sound 60s, it sounds more early 80s, or 70s, I mean, sounds more early 80s, is the birth of the punk scene in around 76, 77. You listen to that first Sex Pistols album, that first Ramones album, and you go, this doesn't sound 70s.
That's because the 80s were born in punk.
Because, I mean, you know, you listen to anything from Nevermind the Bollocks.
Sure.
And if you didn't know that was from the 70s...
It would scream 1980s.
Yeah, you wouldn't know it was from the 70s.
And the reason for that being, I thoroughly believe that just about the entire musical landscape of the 80s was born in punk. Because you had the punks that turned around and made new wave. You had the producers from new wave turn around and do adult contemporary of the 80s. You had the people in punk that were rebelling using the instruments available to them could then afford synthesizers and go, let's play with this. And they went off in all directions from 80s metal to 80s pop to 80s new age, 80s new wave. And they said, let's play with this new electronic instrument and just go crazy with it. And that's why the 80s sound so damn electronic.
Like this. Again, we fought over this song, but this is 80s to me. Do you know it yet? You should.
Two of Hearts.
And see, my choice, I'm almost tempted to make you go back and play my choice too, just to see.
No.
My choice was by the same technical group, was SSQ's Synthicide.
Yeah.
That was going to be my choice.
Yeah, no.
But that immediately went 80s. You got the clear synthesizer sound.
You
have that clear drum machine sound.
Yeah, the electronic drum sound. You had the sampled voice and the, And you had that very, again, that very 80s, I guess you mentioned the drum machine, which would make that very 80s electronic sounding beat. And you immediately listen to it and go, aha, manufactured music.
And I think, I'm not sure if even more so or less so than like auto-tune nowadays. Because the thing, like if you listen to SSQ where she doesn't sample herself as much, she's got a beautiful,
yes,
just amazing voice.
Yeah.
And I think wrecking a voice like that with auto-tune or this synth shit where they're digitally modulating it, That's a crime against music, I think, when you've got a gorgeous singing voice that you're wrecking.
You mentioned, you asked me earlier, you said, what is it in music, and I don't remember if this was before we started recording or not, but you said, what is it that in the 2000s screams early 2000s musically to you, and you just hit it right on the nose.
Auto-tune.
I hear auto-tune, I go, aha, this was popular from about 2001 to about 2008.
And I just think when you've got a gorgeous voice like Stacey Q does or Sue Sad or somebody like that, and you digitize it, it just, you know, it's like taking perfection and saying, no, we need to scribble this up a little bit. And it's too good.
And for that matter, taking a shit voice like, oh, I don't
Rebecca
know.
Black?
T-Pain. Rebecca Black.
T-Pain, I don't know.
Oh, trust me. I mentioned T-Pain. People know what I'm talking about. But, you know,
speaking of the 80s, we could have gone to Pow.
That's true. But taking a shit voice and trying to electronically elevate it or tune it, same thing. Get it the fuck off. If it's a shit voice, it's a shit voice. It doesn't belong on the air.
Well, so you had this kind of 80s.
Right.
And then you also, we could have gone with New Wave. Yep. One of the choices you and I were thinking of was Bow Wow Wow's I Want Candy.
Right.
Or Mickey.
Mickey,
very 80s.
Very
80s. But that's all pop. Or, you've also got the stuff like Motley Crue. You've got the stuff like Iron Maiden, which, sure, you know, as part of the new wave of British heavy metal that, sure, was coming in. You got Diamond Head. You have the last remnants of punk, or the birth of the hardcore punk, where you got the Misfits and Sick of It All and Agnostic Front coming in.
Just About Anything by the Jay Giles Band.
Nah, that's pretty poppy. Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Well, and then you've got the birth of gangsta rap.
Sure.
You know, you got the birth
NWA,
of...
NWA, you've got LL Cool J when he was starting out and still somewhat relative, relevant.
And see, here was...
Public Enemy.
Yeah. And here was the thing about 80s music, and I think even more than the 70s and the 60s before it, 80s music was the most diverse. I don't know if you'll agree with that or not, because I think when you say 80s music, depending on your background, you're going to go to a totally different place. We could have 50 different listeners that, when we said 80s music, went to a different style of music. When we said 70s, I bet we only had a few that went to a different place.
See, and I think you're right in one case. I think it was the most openly diverse. I think that, and what I mean by openly diverse is pop music had its charts. Country music had its charts. Rap had its charts. Techno, which was just starting in the 80s, had its charts. And you could get popular, and or if you're part of the generation that did so, you could link memories with any of these types of music. And you could have a successful rapper that ended up on the radio. You could have a successful metal artist like Anthrax that ended up on the radio. You could have a successful pop artist that ended up on the radio, or you could start. We started to see crossovers like Aerosmith and Run DMC, and yeah, it was so you had a lot of different kinds of music on the radio and available to the public, even more so than we did in the past.
I would say it was arguable diversity, but it was still a narrow diversity for popular music.
Yes.
They were not allowing Anthrax on the radio until the late 80s.
Right. They were
Motley
still...
Crue was not going to get played on the radio until the late 80s. NWA was not going to get radio play until until the 90s. So you still had this very narrow hallway you had to go down. But if you went outside that hallway, there was a lot more choices, yes. I think. A lot more obvious choices.
A lot more choices available to the average person.
Right.
Especially when cassettes took off, because more music was offered on cassette and different types of music were offered on cassette. And they were affordable and available and easier to ship than vinyl.
Yeah, and they were also more durable.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to the 90s, because this actually took a lot longer than I wanted to talk movies. I don't know if we're going to have a lot of time for that.
We'll talk about them, but
as soon as I made this suggestion, we both decided there is no more 90s song than this.
This is the most 90s, and you'll get it in
one beat.
Here we go.
you don't have it yet, I hate you.
Ecstasy, motherfuckers.
This screams to me that manufactured, not in the same way like a boy band, but it's a manufactured fashion culture that was going, look, we're cool.
No.
Because the record label said we're cool.
Actually, what's really funny is these boys, EMF, they were the exact opposite of what you just talked about. They were not manufactured at all. These guys were punks. And they were
they're big, wearing all the latest fashions.
I know that. And that was the video. But EMF got their roots in the club scene.
Because all I see is we're trying to sell you Reebok. We're trying to sell you Nike. We're trying to sell you.
And believe it or not, no. This is going to hurt, but go and watch. Todd in the Shadows actually did a one-hit wonder retrospect on EMF.
I will not
EMF.
Be doing that. You know my...
I know your stance on that one, but if anybody is interested, Todd in the Shadows did a one-hit wonder retrospect on EMF that actually tells you where they came from. These guys are punks, believe it or not. They come out of the punk scene.
I refuse to believe that.
Okay.
But, so 90s music, again, we have the diversity we spoke of in
sure,
the 80s.
Sure.
But also, like I hinted at before, the emasculated male... I will never understand the rise of the boy band in the 90s, Scott. I will never understand that. Why was a pussified group of guys that were totally manufactured the biggest sellers of the entire 1990s?
You realize that exactly what you just said could be applied to the Beatles.
I don't like the Beatles either, and yeah, I don't mind that being applied to the Beatles because that's what they were when they started.
Yeah.
The only time the Beatles got good is... when they hated each other.
Actually, when they all discovered drugs.
Pretty much. But, so, why? Why did the boy bands... Because, seriously, again, if we ask 50 listeners, describe 90s music, I'm going to guess most of them didn't go this, and most of them went to All for One, or Boys to Men, or...
Backstreet Boys?
I thought they were 2000s.
NSYNC?
Were those 90s?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, anything like that. Like, that to me, unfortunately, defines 90s music. And that to me, was that the art form shitting on itself?
No.
Was that shitting the bed?
No, I'll tell you what it was. It was a hearkening back to Motown. It was a hearkening back to the 60s and the early 60s at that with... It was a hearkening. It was a modern version of doo-wop. It was a nice, safe bunch of boys that mom could get horny about and her daughter could get horny about.
Well, not just boys. You had the Spice Girls and, you know, you had the girl groups, too.
Okay, so you had some girl groups thrown in there. Again, just like in the early 1960s, late 50s.
The Cowsills.
A hearkening, you know. And these were a bunch of girls that... Dad could get horny about and his daughter could get horny
okay,
about.
Okay, then why is that immediately, as well as EMF, signified to the 90s? Why is that, as soon as you hear it, you go, fucking 90s.
Beat. That song by EMF, Unbelievable, uses Funky Drummer, which has proliferated at this point across the club scene, across hip-hop, across everything in the 90s. There was even a grunge group, and I forget which song it was, but it used Funky Drummer as its drum beat.
They also use another 90s fad. Oh!
Yeah.
Andrew Dice Clay.
Well, they were the only ones to use Andrew Dice Clay. This
I know, but I'm
song.
Just saying that's another very 90s
but,
thing.
Yeah, but
was
that
Andrew Clay.
That sound and that the humor of Andrew Dice Clay was very, very encapsulated in the 90s.
Exactly.
And it wouldn't fly in any other decade.
Well, he started it in the 80s, though. I've got the old Rodney Dangerfield Young Comic special from 88 where he did some of those jokes. So Dice might not have gotten popular till the 90s, but he was doing that shit in the
80s. Oh, I know he was, but that's what I'm saying. He wouldn't have been able to get popular in the 80s or any other decade than the 90s.
Well, then let's move from music to, because I really don't think the 2000s really need a sample. I mean, nope. You know, it's
still
just,
hear them.
Yeah. So we're skipping the 2000s intentionally. So let's go to movies. Then something like you've got the changing styles in movies. You look at like a 1930s movie. Let's leave like a universal horror out of it. You know, okay. Just like a drama or a crime thriller. They're so safe. They're so ridiculously over the top. They're so sexist. So then you move into the 40s and the 50s. They're still like that. And then in the 60s, they start to change. Why do you think the movies changed when we got to the 60s? Do you think it was the culture of the Flower Children and the hippies and the music was getting harsher, so the movies had to get harsher?
Yeah. I mean, look at how much society in general changed. The 60s, the whole theme behind that revolution, whether you were black, whether you were white, whether you were somebody that was in favor, you know, the typical 50s conservative that was still left behind, or the young 60s liberal revolutionary, we went to war. The country went to war with one another. Blacks went to war with whites trying to get their rights going where they should go. You had the youth going to war with the government and with the old establishment due to Vietnam. And you had that establishment, the 1960s dad that fought for this country in World War II and lived through the post-war 50s and finally has a family in the 60s, and look at these ungrateful brats.
I think you just described Archie Bunker.
You know, we are fighting for freedom in Vietnam, and these fuckers are going against it.
You are so describing Archie Bunker.
You had this generational war, and you had almost a civil war, and you certainly had a cultural war.
But do you think that the movies were a reflection of the time, or the time was a reflection of the movies?
Yes.
I asked you two things. You can't just yes it.
Yes, I can. Because there are plenty of movies that look at this Flower Child generation and that do almost a fictional documentary, for lack of a better word, a time capsule of fiction. And encapsulate that 1960s. And then you also had the revolutionary filmmaker who said, I have all these new techniques. I have something to say. I'm going to make a film that says it. And maybe that film that says it, whatever it happens to be, influences the culture. Whereas the culture influences the filmmaker that says, I want to follow these Flower Children from Minnesota to California.
It's cyclical is what you're saying.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's cyclical. I'm saying that they both exist at once.
Well, then what about when you do have something, it's almost like a short-sightedness I've seen in movies and TV specifically, even more than music or art. And that is, this is made for now. We're not thinking about where the future is for this project, this movie, this TV series. It's now. That's why we have everyone wearing afros and bell bottoms and Aquanet and all this, that we don't care that this is not going to play right 20 years from now. You know, my brother still to this day cannot watch the original Dawn of the Dead because he cannot stop laughing at the afros on the zombies.
Well,
and it's like, you're really, because the zombies have afros, you're not willing to watch this film.
Of course it's made for now. They're not marketing a movie in 20 years. They're not. Hollywood is not making Shakespeare. It might make adaptations of Shakespearean plays, but it's not looking for the same timeless capsule of storytelling. And you can't. Because, as we've even seen, movies that predict the future become time capsules themselves. The Jetsons. Obviously, 50s,
Escape from
even
New York.
Escape from New York. You know,
Videodrome. Even though Videodrome didn't take place in the future, the revolutionary ideas in it are, and I don't think Cronenberg could have seen this coming, are stuck in the analog era.
Right.
So is that short-sightedness, or was he just kind of, I got to make my money back now?
No, he said, I have a story to tell. these are the tools I know I can use to tell that story. In that case, VHS and
Beta, actually.
Yeah, well, Beta and the analog side of it all. I can't predict the future accurately enough to write an accurate story for the future 40 years down the road. I can't. And I don't know who can. Because if I write a story where I am predicting the future, it becomes one of those where they look back and go, how quaint, they thought it would be like this.
Okay, well, that's what I'm asking then. Then do the movies, and you think, and I'm making the movies, I'm personifying them as the filmmakers, the writers, the studios, whatever. Right. Do the movies try and make themselves a time capsule, or do you think that is just what happens?
That's
or do you think they're made for it?
I think they're using the tools that they have at the moment to tell the story they want to tell. And because it becomes a story that we all pay attention to and a story that we that becomes part of us and part of our society, at that moment, it becomes a time capsule of that moment. I don't think anybody set out until the 2000s to make a movie that everybody knew was made in the 1980s.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is now we have filmmakers who are going, okay, let's use the technology of 30 years ago. Let's make it look like it was made 30 years ago. Let's make it look historical.
Well, you did have sprinklings of that, like Young Frankenstein, for example.
Yeah, okay.
Frankenstein was made to look and feel like a 30s Universal
film.
You're right.
But
those were isolated incidents.
Right, but those were isolated
incidents. That was not
the
culture. Now, you can't go a month without seeing a new trailer in the modern era for some throwback movie that is made to look like it's from the 80s or from the 70s or from the 60s or from the 30s or from the 90s. It's almost like we're obsessed with going back. What's really ironic is that our show is all about going back.
Right.
So I just called us out.
What I think is even more ironic is that I think in the future we're going to look back on these movies that were, you know, made to look like older, and they will become themselves part of a cultural time capsule of the 2010s.
Of the 2010s looking back at the
1980s. Of the 2010s, period. Looking back at the 80s and making that retro filmmaker feel will become eventually a time capsule of the 2010s.
What about with video games then? You've got more
retro
games that are made to seem like they're 80s and 90s style games now than you ever have.
And I think that this whole retro feel, you know, we will look back at the 2010s.
Is it just trying to recapture our childhood?
Yes.
We're just, you know, this is our memories. Or like with Mel Brooks, his memories were of the Universal Monster film. So he's like, I want to make one of those.
Yep.
But they don't make those today. So I need to go out of my way to make one of those.
Yep. And that's precisely what's happening now. I mean, this is the first decade where we've really been able to have good retro games. Think about it.
Overall, yeah.
Period. I mean, the birth of the home video revolution, the really big one, was the Atari 2600.
Yep. Which was 70s.
Well,
it got big in the 80s, but it started in the 70s.
There you go. Most of us, 80s. Even, you know, the generation behind us, they're nostalgic about the Nintendo, the NES. And we look back on those as retro gaming. We're trying to recapture our childhood. That's why we see such a rise now. And I think in the future, in 2028, we'll be talking about how the 2010s was the retro decade.
I can't say you're wrong. I'd like to.
Of course you can't say I'm wrong. It's because I'm a genius.
I can't say you're wrong because in this one case, isolated case, that we actually agree.
I know.
So I hope we dealt nicely with how art, as art, it's both dated and it's timeless. Because like I brought up my initial comic book example, those have a certain feel to them that is kind of warming.
They have a timeless charm.
I don't know if charm is the right word.
It may not be a timeless image, but there is a timeless, heartwarming charm.
Well, like in a way, you see some old Marvel Comics cover with with like Luke Cage with a big afro and looking as 70s as ever, and you just kind of go, oh, how cute.
Exactly.
You know, wow, that was wow.
And, you know, that makes me think of something else. something else that's kind of retro.
Kaiju movies?
We'll see you next week.
Lost in the Static is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.